From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack, and I'm reading from the script that Evan wrote, so
don't,
I will read word by word.
Don't read the script. Don't read the script. Once in a while, this is not something that our listeners need to know. We have a little fun with the script, but you don't need to read the script.
That's too bad. We'll have to do a separate episode where it's just banter. What's really in the script?
Actual scripted banter. You know what my favorite kind of banter is in news? Scripted banter.
Scripted banter.
Oh, that's good.
When you rehearse and practice.
Oh, that's really good. It's very natural.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good. Should we actually just get to what happened this week on the program?
Probably. That's probably a good idea.
Should. Yeah, let's get to it. We started with Rochester City Council. They're getting ready to vote on a resolution that would formally make Rochester a sanctuary city. There's a term you've probably heard a lot in the news recently. That means that the city would follow all federal laws, wouldn't break federal laws, but it would not go the extra mile in helping detain people on immigration or other status charges.
We took a phone call from a listener named Nancy who expressed a fear of some immigrants, and then she explained why she thinks immigrants today are different than the kinds of immigrants who came to the U.S. when she was growing up. You'll hear her comments, followed by Carly Fox of the Worker Justice Center and Kaylin Rich of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
We're all immigrants. Every single person in this country is an immigrant, except for the Native American Indian. But years ago when my grandfathers came over here, they helped to rebuild this country to what it is today. They went to work all day. They stood in lines, took that little loaf of bread, brought it home. Here, honey, here's 25 cents. Go to the store, get milk for the kids and whatnot, and do what you can. And they were very proud to do that. They come here nowadays, and they're on the system. Who's paying for that? You and I?
They're on the system, Nancy. I mean, really?
Are they coming here? Yes, really.
You think they just come here and they don't want to work? That's what your vision is of this? Nancy, that there's some racism in that. That's not true. That is not true at all. I mean, are you talking to people who come here? They want to work. They want to raise families, right?
Yeah. But I see more and more people getting a handout. Sorry.
Thanks for the phone call, Nancy. Some thoughts from our panel on that?
I would just say that they're paying an incredible amount of money in taxes they'll never see a benefit from, and including into the Social Security system that they'll never retrieve. In fact, they're holding up our Social Security system right now. So it's actually the opposite. All of the sales taxes, property tax that is going into the system. And define criminal. And what are they protecting us from? I mean, really, what do we need to be protected from? As far as I can see, we are benefiting from having cheap food. We have cheap food so we can spend more money on other things.
But Nancy's saying that the immigrants are coming here and they don't want to work.
Right.
They're coming here to get on our system.
If someone is undocumented in this country, they will go hungry. They are not eligible for anything. In fact, injured workers, you know, they are eligible for workers' comp. Good thing most labor law is equally applied. Otherwise, our worker rights would be horrendous for everybody. But if you're on workers' comp and the case is being controverted, you have nothing to live on. You will go hungry and homeless.
Yeah, I would just invite Nancy. You seems like a nice person. You know, meet people. Talk to people. Sit down with people in their community. I mean, I meet people all the time who've come here and they just want to work. And they don't want to be on the system at all. But Kaylin, to her point, that she thinks laws are already on the books and just not being enforced. What do you think?
I think that's just patently false. You know, I mean, I agree that laws are on the books. And I think what we're saying here is that we have separate entities to deal with the civil violation of being undocumented. So that's federal immigration authorities, ICE and CBP, the Border Patrol. And then we also have law enforcement that deals with criminal issues in our city. That's the Rochester Police Department. In the county, it's the Monroe County Sheriff's Department, and there's other municipal law departments around here. And we were just saying, let's be clear about this is your job and this is your job. And there's, you know, we don't want to cross over. Federal immigration law is very complex. Local law enforcement shouldn't be doing federal immigration enforcement. It can expose our local police and sheriff's departments to civil liability and ultimately create massive costs to taxpayers in the form of defending lawsuits. So, again, sanctuary cities is not about breaking the law, and it's not about refusing to uphold the law. It's about clarifying what the role is of these various enforcement agencies, and that it's voluntary for our local police to get involved in these civil matters.
Next, we had a conversation about the Dakota Access Pipeline. The Obama administration blocked its construction late last year, but President Trump has given it the green light. He says he doesn't even think it's controversial, despite the fact that tens of thousands of Americans have gone to Standing Rock to protest.
A federal judge blocked a request by a North Dakota tribe to stop construction based on religious grounds. The judge determined that there was no standing for that claim, which was upsetting to Michael Galbin, a historian with the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan. You'll hear him first in this clip, and then Sue Hughes Smith from the People's Climate Coalition.
When we talk about law and Native people and religious rights, it is a fact that up until 1978, within my lifetime, Native people did not have the same protections, religious freedom, as other people in the United States. That's 1978. And in accordance with that law, we have a right to access our sacred sites and a right to have them protected, a right to perform our sacred ceremonies, and access to the materials required. And some of these lands are those, in fact, those places. So this is in violation of our Religious Freedom Act, a recent act. So, you know, we're starting from a real deficit. And I think that the choice to select that argument legally was very considerate and testing what is really federal law. And we can see by the federal judge's decision that that law does not matter.
Sue, you want to weigh in on that as well?
Yeah, just to the extent that this is just more of a series of injustices that have occurred, right? When the Army Corps initially determined where they were going to allow the pipeline, they were supposed to consult with the tribe. They sent one letter. They did not answer three requests from Dave Archbold to meet with them. So in a sense, it's the Army Corps insisting on doing things their way without regard to the ways in which the indigenous leaders operate and function, and an unwillingness to respect their ways and properly have that consultation.
I feel like what I'm hearing from Michael Galbin, and as a white guy in the room, the guy who tries to just listen at times, is when I listen to Native people talk about this, it feels like if there were 100 cases regarding Native beliefs and 100 cases regarding Judeo-Christian beliefs, guess who's going to get the short end of it? That's sort of the point, is that, you know, when you look at the wide range of this, this has been happening to Native people for decades and centuries now, and this just feels like another mark in invalidating a belief system. Michael, is that fair?
That's pretty much what I'm saying, yeah. Okay. I mean, historically, we have been in the short end of the stick in terms of seeking justice with law in the United States. It is just a historic fact. And to totally disregard a people and their concerns and religious concerns is absolutely horrible and inexcusable.
Okay. Sue?
Yeah, thanks, Evan. I just want to add a little bit to the religious discussion, mm-hmm. because it's much more complex than we like to acknowledge. There are Native people who follow their Native traditions. At the same time, they are adherents or participants in Judeo-Christian tradition. I traveled in December out to Standing Rock with an interfaith group led by the Rochester Episcopal Diocese, and we went in support of and to support the Episcopal priest who is and has been in Standing Rock for decades. And Native communities on the plains can be anywhere from 25% to 75% Episcopalian. So it is more nuanced than what we often discuss. Mm-hmm. And we need to respect the people's belief systems when they are coming forward and saying, this is a sacred site to us that should hold weight, that shouldn't be determined by someone else saying, oh, that is or isn't a sacred site to you. And as Father Floberg showed us when we arrived, the sacred mounds, you know, there are any number of bluffs the police could have set up on to defend the pipeline, but they chose to stand on the most sacred ground that the Native peoples had agreed never to fight on, mm-hmm. to not have weapons on, and it's a clear violation when the police, with their weapons, go onto that land. And so it just shows a fundamental disrespect.
Moving on, Friday was Black Lives Matter Day in the Rochester City School District. Teachers had the option of tailoring their lesson plans to subjects pertaining to African American history, injustice, inequality, and more.
Some listeners didn't like the idea of the school district endorsing Black Lives Matter. This clip starts with a phone call from a listener named Robert. Then you'll hear the panel respond. It includes a science teacher named Chris Widmeyer and an assistant principal named LaJuan Brown.
I just don't think it's the school's purpose to kind of align itself with a particular political movement. I mean, you have a school district where 5% of the students graduate ready for college. I mean, if they were graduating 95% ready for college, it might be a different situation where you could explore more experimental topics and whatnot, but I just don't think so. The other thing is, it just puts the school in a position where they're sort of preaching sort of a cult of victimization, kind of grievance grooming for the future. And it turns the school into sort of an indoctrination factory. If you look at what the Black Lives Matter statement is on their website, it says that they're an ideological and political intervention in a world where black lives are systematically and intentionally targeted for demise. I just think that's strong.
Okay, so Robert, hang there for a second, because to you, this is political. What our panelists were saying earlier is they don't view Black Lives Matter and what's going to happen on Friday in Rochester schools as political. You're saying you disagree. You find it political.
That's correct.
Okay, so stay there, and let's let our panelists respond to some of what they're hearing there.
Well,
go ahead, Chris.
Had a chance to think of some of what you said just by reading some of the blogs and websites that have been out there that are in opposition to this, and I can't understand where you're coming from and what experiences you've had that have led you to these sorts of conclusions. You know, in terms of the success rate in the Rochester City School District, that is something that needs to be addressed. And like LaJuan said earlier, it's about knowing our students. And I come at it from that perspective that I need to know my students. I need to have a relationship with them before we can see any sort of success. And, you know, and in terms of schools that have a 95% graduation rate, it doesn't matter what the races of the students are at those schools. They need to address the important social challenges that our country faces. And so that's where I'm coming from on this.
LaJuan?
And I believe our graduation rate is 43%.
He said college readiness.
Oh, college readiness. Okay, my fault.
I don't know what the numbers are. I think Robert mentioned college readiness. But go ahead, LaJuan.
So, but our graduation rate has increased, but it's okay, and it could be better, so I do want to say that. And again, if you don't know who you're dealing with, and if you don't acknowledge that racism exists in our society, the one thing that the schools have not talked about, we've talked about Common Core, we've talked about getting students the basics and the standards and everything else that they need, but the one thing that we don't talk about in schools is students' culture, especially students of color in urban district. That's never talked about. Perhaps this is the one nugget that we need to talk about, and we will see a difference in student academic achievement.
LaJuan, I think some of what Robert's saying when it comes to his concern about what he used the term victimization or, you know, kind of grievance grooming, what I often hear from people, and I don't know if Robert self-identifies, who's still in line with us, as conservative or not, but one of the concerns that I hear is if we raise kids to think that society is going to try to crush them, that they're less likely to be able to be convinced of their own ability to rise above. And again, I'm not endorsing any position. I'm just trying to kind of follow up on what I've heard often. What do you say to that?
I don't think we're raising kids to think that. It already exists in our society. We don't need to tell kids that. Society is already telling them that. If you look at what's going on with our current, I don't want to get too political, but if you look at what's going on in regards to people of color and Muslims and things of that nature, society is already saying, we don't want you. And society for a long time has done things to African Americans, people of color, letting us know in advance that they're not particularly happy with us. And the system is set up in that way as well.
Okay. Maureen, what do you think?
I agree, and I would go back to the statement that we had as organizers, that this is a day to affirm and understand that Black Lives Matter at school. It's not political. It's a human issue, and that we are talking about people in our society and how we can do everything possible to affirm and to see them, to value them, and to say that they matter, that their trials and tribulations are ours as well.
Okay, Tim?
Well, being a student of the district, it does feel like at times that our culture is shut down at the door. I feel like Black Lives Matter isn't a movement that makes me feel like I'm weaker, but it makes me feel that I'm stronger. School is more than just a place for you to learn your math or English. It's a place to practice equality, build understanding, and I'm thankful to come from a school that does focus on these values so much, and I feel like that makes me a well-rounded citizen and student.
Let's wrap up with a surprising twist in the climate change debate. A growing list of senior Republicans says it's time to take climate change seriously and do something about it. That group is led by James Baker, former Secretary of State.
The question is whether current members of Congress will respond and agree to support legislation to address climate change. The most popular proposal is called a carbon fee and dividend, which would tax the production of carbon, but that revenue would be returned to American taxpayers. The idea is that it's revenue neutral, not a government fundraiser, but an incentive for energy companies to focus on new sources.
So this clip starts with James Baker talking on CNN, and then you're going to hear Peter Brin, the conservative leader of the Citizens Climate Lobby, and then you'll hear Rob Levine, a volunteer with the local branch of the Climate Lobby.
How do you convince a president who has said at one point that he thought climate change was a hoax generated by the Chinese?
Well, I'm not sure we do, and we may not, but this is a good plan, both from a policy standpoint and from a political standpoint. It is a problem, right now at least. And Republicans have not been at the table because we've been basically skeptics or deniers. Now, when you have companies like BP and Exxon and Total and Shell all saying we ought to have a carbon tax of some sort, I think we ought to listen to that.
That's James Baker talking to CNN. I want to ask all of our guests what they think. I'll start with Peter Brin here. Is his voice strong enough to get people to listen who are actually in elected office right now, Peter?
You know, that's to be seen. I think that's an interesting question. You know, of course, James Baker is incredibly well respected amongst Republican establishment. But of course, this is an interesting time where the establishment is, you know, not certainly the only faction within the party that has a lot of strength. And so I obviously am hopeful. I think the good that could come out of this is obvious. You know, there may be some longtime Republicans who will look at this and consider, well, you know, folks in my own tribe are starting to come out on this and say that this is an issue. And not only this is an issue, but here's a good conservative way to deal with it. On the flip side, you know, I've made the frog in a boiling pot analogy where, you know, a lot of what Citizens Climate Lobby does is working locally in district behind the scenes, getting things done in Congress, moving things along slowly. We're sort of the organization that's slowly put a temperature up in the pot of water. When you take folks with the gravitas of Hank Paulson and Jim Baker and others and put them out there in front of the national media, that's sort of throwing the frog into a boiling pot. So I'm wondering if the reaction, I'm still kind of on the lookout for what the reaction will be. So, you know, I'm hopeful. I think we have to be careful about how we use this, but I do think there's a huge opportunity here. And to add to that, the council, my understanding is this is what they're calling a phase one. Phase two, they're going to bring out a lot of other folks and, you know, folks who I think maybe, no disrespect to Mr. Baker, but perhaps more relevant today in the sense of current business leaders from around the country whose names carry weight, you know, in more modern times.
Sure. All right, Rob Levine, what do you think of what you heard from James Baker?
Well, I agree that there may be some skepticism with those in government right now, but what we're excited about is that we have Republican leadership taking the cap off the bottle and saying, one, it's okay to talk about climate change, admitting that there's some human element involved in it, and that the risk of not doing anything about it is so great, regardless of the cause, that we need to do something about it like a carbon fee and dividend. So we're looking locally, and we've seen it in the last 2 months, that a lot more people are interested in our organization because they want to get involved. And so we're kind of hoping we'll see some more conservatives who have maybe felt that climate change is an issue, but thought it was taboo to speak about if you're a conservative, who now may say, you know what, it's time to get involved.
That's all for Weekend Connections, the podcast. Cue the music. There you go. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, including scripted banter, and we'll talk to you on Monday.
We should have scripted a great goodbye.
But
we can't read what's on the script, so we'll just say bye, talk to you Monday. Yes, it is Monday.
Yes,
it's a holiday, but we're still talking to you Monday.
Yes.
Monday it is. Bye.